One that would know how much I'm butchering anatomy of the heart and lung as I talk about it. But there is another person back here, Greta Craftser. Greta, wave your hand. Greta is a very important person in everything that we do on the projects I'm going to talk about today. Greta's, you really talk about the perpetual student. She's done it. She's a DVM from CSU and then master's and then became a board certified pathologist. And now is part of the pathology team for the Vet Diagnostic Clinic group here in Brookings for the state of South Dakota. And she's a really critical person that helps us do the pathology of things that I talk about very grossly. So without her help, and I'll do like Jenny did. So when all the hard questions come, Greta will know, okay? So we're going to talk about pulmonary hypertension and... so what the heck does that even mean? I mean, most people think of hypertension, you think of high blood pressure, and you could think of it that way. In the human world, right, we can measure that really easy with the spinopharmometer, put that on our arm. That's a little harder to do in a large bovine. And so typically we don't do a lot of systemic measurement of hypertension in cattle. We think about things, though, with pulmonary hypertension is because we've got bad things going on between heart and lungs, and then that starts to affect the rest of the animal. And so I'm going to talk about that kind of within two realms. One realm is something that we've talked about for a century, and that's high-altitude cattle, and then something we've been talking about a lot in the last 5 years, and that is hypertension, pulmonary hypertension issues in feedlot cattle. So before I get started into all this, I just want to say I don't do all this by myself. Again, I introduced Greta Craftser. This is a big project that involves breeding and genetics at CSU and various people that work in the health professions, DVMs, MDs, whatnot. There we go. Guess when you become a department head, you become incompetent at doing anything with a slide projector. Anyway, so the health profession group that we work with, Greta's a big deal of that. But I'm going to talk a lot about pulmonary arterial pressure, and we get that basically because of the work of one remarkable person called Tim Holt. He's also a DVM. He's kind of the leader in the Western United States on what we do as far as PAP testing goes. And I'm going to talk a lot about that and what it means and so forth. But a lot of our data sets wouldn't exist if there wasn't the PAP data that we got first from Dr. Holt and so forth. And so lots of folks involved in these projects, and I don't want to dare start reading off names because I would leave out somebody important. So a lot of people think about everything that we do in Colorado has to do with high altitude. And this, the browner this part of the picture, the higher the elevation. And so that's true. When we talk about cow-calf operations and developing bulls and heifers and whatnot for breeding programs in the mountains, that's a big part of it. But we also need to realize that we have a great high plain across the United States. Some people use terms like the northern Great Plains or the southern high plains, those kind of language. So there's a huge plains. It starts, you know, down about Lubbock, Texas, and goes up to at least Cheyenne or maybe further north that contains a big chunk of what we call the U.S. feedlot industry. You know, we're talking about an area of the world that produces maybe 20% of the world's beef, that kind of thing. And so when we talk about that region, you know, us in Colorado say, well, that's low elevation, but it's not really low elevation. It's moderate elevation. I mean, Denver sets on the plains before you go up into the mountains. And Denver is mile high, 5,280 feet, right? Where my house sits in Windsor, Colorado, is above 5,000 feet. You know, there's a lot of elevation there. And so we're starting to see a lot of issues in cattle on what we call the plains. We call that a moderate elevation. And so we'll talk about what implications or ramifications are maybe of that. So when we talk about pulmonary hypertension, really... that's a pretty getting pretty technical. Really what we're talking about is animals that are deficient in oxygen or hypoxia. So why in the world would an animal become hypoxic? Well, an easy one to talk about is the higher the altitude you go, the less the partial pressure of oxygen. So therefore, the more of a, it's easy for an animal to get hypoxic, or yourself. If you were to fly from Houston, Texas to to Denver, Colorado and go up in the mountains and go for a hike, you're probably going to feel pretty hypoxic, and it's not going to feel real good. But there's lots of other ways for an animal to get hypoxic. Endurance sports, you know, long distance running, endurance horse racing, the Iditarod dog race, on and on and on. You know, those are pretty hypoxic situations after a participant has gone through it for a while. Any kind of major lung disease, like we call bovine respiratory disease, pretty serious lung damage to an animal, reduces their ability to breathe. Any kind of anemia, blood flow restriction. You know, we've talked a lot at this meeting over the years about endophyte infected fescue and its effect on the extremities. There would be something that puts an animal hypoxic. Anything that would cause tissue metabolism to become more anaerobic rather than aerobic. You know, so it would be glycolytic. That could cause it. And then there's a lot of data today, particularly in humans, about obesity in humans and hypoxic states and the impacts of that on cardiopulmonary function and so forth. So there's a lot of reasons an animal could become hypoxic. There was a news report last week, and this is just totally anecdotal. Anybody see that? About some gentleman, he was from Iowa. He was on one of the teams that climbed Mount Everest. So he did that for several weeks, and then he went back to Iowa and participated in a marathon. And at the end of the marathon, guess what happened? He died of some kind of pulmonary hypertension thing. Anybody see that in the news? So probably some of those things are pretty related, right? Okay, so a lot of what I'm going to talk about today, at least in the first half of my talk, are some things that we recently wrote in an article that's posted on the CAB website. And that's this article right here. This whole big team of people, we worked on that for better than a year. It's about the best review article that we could put together at this point. And you can download that off the CAB website. When I get to the second half of my talk, though, I'm going to start talking about some new data that we're just, every day we get more data in on this project. Particularly it's related to the feedlot health part of this project. Okay, so let's think about the growth curve a minute. A lot of what we talk about when we talk about pulmonary hypertension, particularly if we talk about cattle and altitude, we're talking about selecting replacement bulls and heifers. And so we typically measure, you know, pulmonary hypertension or pulmonary arterial pressure, you know, when they're yearlings, but some people do it as weanlings. We do a lot of that at one of our experimentation facilities, because the sooner we know if an animal's not tolerating altitude, the sooner we'd like to get rid of them, that kind of thing. And so we have a lot of data and a lot of knowledge about these two data points. Okay, so in the western U.S., maybe there's about 10,000 animals papped each year. Tim Holt probably does the largest chunk of those, but then there's veterinarians, particularly that have all been trained through various training programs that we do at CSU that go around and do this as well. And then we have a group in Denver and some facilities on the CSU campus where we can put baby calves in a hypobaric chamber and crank the altitude level up to like they're at 15,000 feet. And there's been decades worth of people doing research with that and looking at the impact of that, not only on baby calf health, but also for human medicine and comparisons in neonatology and so forth. So we got a lot of knowledge. But when it starts to come out here to what we say the flat part of the growth curve, when we talk about fattening cattle, that's where we're on new ground, okay? And so that's the latter part of what I'm going to talk about is we're trying to gain more knowledge so that we can understand why when we're fattening feedlot cattle, we sometimes get pulmonary hypertension and have cattle die from that as well. Okay, so I've had a lot of fun over the past few years. As I've worked on pulmonary hypertension, of everybody telling me what they think the problem is and why it exists. And so I'll put together just a quick little slide set so that we could just flip through that and we could laugh about it and say, oh my God, whatever we're going to say. But then after that, then we're going to get down to talking about data and what we really do know. Okay? So I'll go through this really quick just so I don't run out of time for Dr. Inns, but I call this myth-busters or just things that people have told me, you know, about pulmonary hypertension and that kind of thing. So I don't think our system's very good, Mark. There it goes. Yeah, so there are many ruminant animals that are tolerant of altitude, so therefore cattle should also be tolerant of altitude, right? So that's a picture of a bull elk, you know, at about 9,000 feet. Obviously, he's tolerant of altitude. The Rocky Mountain sheep, our mascot at CSU, you know, they climb up the sides of the mountains. They're all tolerant of altitude, so therefore other ruminants should be tolerant of altitude. Right. Cattle from, I took this picture in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France. So no one over there has ever heard of high altitude disease. So therefore the solution is to bring their cattle over here and we'll get rid of this problem. I think we did that right after World War II. We did a lot of that, right? So that's obviously not the solution. Some people think just because we selected cattle to be too short and chubby and then we changed them to be too tall. You know, now we made them really thick. Yearling weight's still going up. Even though they're not so tall anymore, they're getting thicker and thicker. Okay? And then some people say, you know, well, it's because we've turned them all black. But that's not true either. Right? Tim Holt at PAPSAR does all these PAPS around the Western United States. Would kind of give that classic statement we say about genetics within a breed versus across breeds. That there's probably more variation within most breeds than there are across breeds. But we do see this syndrome in other breeds. Okay, and probably there were some really smart Hereford breeders that had a lot of this figured out in probably 60s, 70s, and some of those days, but they've given way to Angus breeding, and some of that knowledge is gone. Some people say the problem is that we've turned our cattle into poultry, right? And there's a condition in poultry known as flip-over disease or ascites, and they, you know, which greatly changed the modern turkey from, you know, this size breast to this size breast. And therefore, that's why we eat leftovers after Thanksgiving dinner for almost 2 weeks, right? Because of the size of that turkey breast, those kinds of things. But I don't think it's quite that dramatic. So I think the issue here is there's just a lot to learn. And so this was kind of the title of my talk. What's the alphabet soup of all of this issue about pulmonary hypertension and what do we need to learn about it? So we're talking about pulmonary hypertension, and here I will abbreviate that PH. And even though pulmonary hypertension is really an interaction between the heart and the lung, it's most easily seen from the right side of the heart. And so we'll talk a lot about the RV, right ventricle. We measure that pressure, and I'll talk about that in a minute, how we do that with pulmonary arterial pressure. When we talk about cattle that have died in the mountains, we, for lack of a better word, there's lots of different terms. Most ranchers would say it's brisket disease, but we would call that high mountain disease. And then we sometimes see it in the feedlot, and we're going to call that feedlot heart disease. A lot of people, and me included, started initially calling it late feedlot death, and I'm going to show you some data on how that starts to occur as cattle fatten, late feedlot death. And a lot of pen riders, those kind of folks, will tell you, they just call it a heart failure. They'll call you up and say, hey, we got another one of your heart failures over here. Y'all want to take that to the diagnostic lab, that kind of thing. You know, and you can't ignore that maybe one of the biggest culprit of lung disorders or lung challenges in the beef industry is bovine respiratory disease. And I'll talk a little bit about a challenge study that we're using the bovine respiratory syncytial virus, BRSV. And of course, this is BIF, right? And so we're supposed to be talking about GEPDs, right? Isn't that what we're supposed to talk about in here? Yeah, so it is. It's an alphabet soup. Yeah, so let me talk a little bit about PAP and how we measure that. So PAP, pulmonary arterial pressure, is an indicator of pulmonary hypertension. And we use that as an indicator trait to determine whether an animal kind of tolerates altitude or not. Okay? And so how do we measure pulmonary arterial pressure? Well, we put a catheter through the jugular vein, put the animal in the chute, turn their head with the halter, run a catheter through the jugular vein, through the right side of the heart, this would be the RV here, right ventricle right here, right atrium here, up into the pulmonary artery, and we measure the pressure. And then that will be a pressure waveform, as well looking on an oscilloscope. So you have systole up here and diastole down there, and usually we use the mean arterial pressure, that's the trait. Okay? So if that trait number, usually if that number's like 41 or 2 or lower, we say the animal's handling altitude, and that's pretty good. But as that number goes up, we say they're not handling altitude or they're in a hypoxic state, okay? And then once they get up in that hypoxic state, one of two things can happen. And here's where it gets really variable. That can have a huge, terrible impact on the animal, and you could lose the animal, it develops brisket disease, and they die. And what you see happening is that the right side of the heart will start to malform like this. Instead of that being very nice and apical, it's starting to look like a volleyball. Okay? And again, it could be a lung issue, but we look at the heart initially, just gross anatomically, because it's easy to look at the heart. Even a guy like me can do that. I probably can't do her foot scores, but I'm pretty sure I can look at that and tell you it looks more like a volleyball than a heart. Okay? Or it's just very strange that you'll have some animals that'll just tolerate it. The same way you may know somebody that has high blood pressure and they don't feel very good, and you know somebody else that has high blood pressure and they really struggle with it in their life and on a lot of medications and so forth. Some animals will tolerate it. Here's a picture of a bull. This is a son of QAS Traveler 23-4. Anybody ever heard of that bull? I didn't think so. Anyway, one of the most known Angus bulls ever lived in the world. And that bull right there had extremely high PAP, but he just tolerated it. And it just didn't seem to bother him. Okay? And that's another story for another day. But that's what you get, is that when and why we start to talk about PAP and risk categories rather than the actual trait itself a lot, particularly when we talk among breeders. Okay, so here's some data just to look at what does PAP look like as a trait. So this is PAP on this axis. This is a distribution level. So this is a bell curve of about 5,600 animals. Okay? And so what you get typically is you get a fairly normal looking bell curve and then this wild tail of high PAPers. Okay? And when you get out in that wild tail, yeah, some of those will die. They'll develop brisket disease and die, but some will tolerate it. Okay? And so if we put them into those categories, typically we say a PAP is around 41 or 2 or less, so about right here in this way on the bell curve, they're low risk of anything bad happening from high PAP. If they're moderate, 42 to 49 millimeters of mercury, which makes up about 38% of a population, 50% in group 1, you know, we say they're at moderate risk of anything bad happening from having high PAP. If they're 50 or above, which is about 10% of an Angus population, then we say they're at high risk of developing brisket disease or other bad things happening, you know, from having pulmonary hypertension. Okay, so here's a table that I could really spend the rest of this time talking about. It's a quick and dirty lit review as far as this presentation goes, but I want people to start to get a feel for what is PAP and what is high versus low, because the semantics of that can be very challenging. Okay, so let's start right here. This yellow line are some Angus cross cows that were PAPed at sea level. Okay, they're not growing, they're mature animals, not stressed from anything. And notice that they have a PAP of an average about 34, okay, with a range of 28 to 41. So we'd say those are all low-risk cattle, and they was PAPed at sea level. Now let's go to the bottom part of this, and let's look at what PAP would look like in some other animals that are very tolerant of altitude or a hypoxic condition. So here's an American bison, average PAP of 29. Here's a Himalayan cow, average PAP of 26. And then what is thought of between those and llamas, the most tolerant altitude animals in the world, a yak, okay? They have a PAP of about 20, even in an extreme altitude, 3,700 meters, okay? So then here's what PAP on a healthy human would look like, 25. Think about that. I just told you that 40 and below is good in cattle, 41 or 2 below is good. And a healthy human at low altitude, almost sea level, will have a PAP of about 25. So that's very low. Okay? If we have people that are suffering from some kind of cardiopulmonary malformation, disease, whatever, they have PAP that will be greater than 35 in a range of 15 to 70. Okay? Think about that a minute. 35 to 15 to 70. Now let's go up here and let's look at what cattle PAPs look like at altitude. So this is just a bunch of various data. I'm not going to go all these lines, but here's 2,400 bulls that were PAPed at an experiment station in southwest Colorado, known as the Four Corners Bull Test. They have an average PAP of 45, ranging from 29 to 145. So they would be almost, not quite, but almost double what PAP is in a normal human. Okay? Now let's go to feedlot cattle. Okay? These are some animals on feed at the Eastern Colorado Research Center. And they had, Pat, before they went to slaughter, averaging 54. That is more than double a healthy human. Okay? So what I'm telling you is, in general, pap in bovines, particularly Bos taurus bovines that we work with in the United States, they have pap that's substantially higher than what a person would have. Okay? That's just, I'm not saying that's good, bad, or otherwise. That's just the way they are. Okay? So as we go to thinking about the rest of my talk, and we talk about stressing cattle with altitude or stressing cattle in a feedlot, when you have an animal that already has a pretty high pulmonary arterial pressure, they're not going to be an animal that's going to tolerate very many kinds of stresses, or it's going to put them in a state of pulmonary hypertension. Okay? I'm not arguing that's good, bad, or otherwise. I'm saying that's the cattle we work with today. That's the way they are. Okay, so something else that we've been doing so that... It's just slow. Another thing we've been doing is that a lot of this pap testing and the things we do with Dr. Crafter and those kind of things, those are very intensive design studies, okay? And that's really good when you're just trying to learn when something is, but when you want to do genome-enhanced EPDs, we all know that we need tons of data on lots of animals. So I just wanted to put this slide up. So we've been developing a heart scoring system so that we could go to packing plants and maybe get samples on animals before they go and samples of data before they go so that we could start to learn more what are the big impacts, particularly in the feedlot setting, of having animals with pulmonary hypertension. So we've come up with a heart scoring system, and I'm not going to show a lot of data from this today, but this would be what the normal heart looks like, and we give that a score of 1. And then here is an animal that is a 5. This would be the most severely malformed heart that we've ever seen. Okay, so then, you know, 2, 3, and then really what you really see changing as the animal goes from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 is start to watch the right side of the heart or the right ventricle start to bulge out. And so what that's happening is that the right ventricle is working against the pulmonary artery, and so maybe something's happening in the lung or with the pulmonary artery itself, but the animal is hypertensive. Okay, and so what happens is the pulmonary artery in most of the larger vessels in the lung are supposed to be very elastic. So each time the right side of the heart pumps, those things are supposed to expand and contract, you know, with each pump. But if an animal's hypoxic, then the right side of the heart's going to pump really fast. And those things are going to expand and contract a lot. And when they start to do that very much, they're going to get inflamed. And so then the opposite starts to happen of what you hope would happen. You would hope that it would get more elastic and be able to deal with that, but that's not what happens. Those tissues become inflamed, and so then they start to become rigid and they start to malform, and that pulmonary artery loses all of its ability to be elastic and becomes as stiff as a water hose. And so then the right side of the heart is just pumping harder and harder, trying to pump blood through there. And so it starts to malform in response to that. And then everything that happens after that is just all downhill. The animal's going to start to have... The liver will change color and become this kind of odd nutmeg color and start to lose its sharp edges and start to be more rounded. If you ever see this, you're never going to forget it. You're going to know, oh my gosh, that's one of those brisket disease livers. And then eventually the animal's going to start to dump major amounts of fluid into the thoracic cavity, you know, and the brisket will start to swell. Okay, therefore the classic rancher term, brisket disease. And then once in a while, and I'm going to show some pictures later, once in a while you'll even get an animal that looks like it has water belly. You know, and probably some nutritionists could tell us that, you know, probably had something to do with urinary calculi or something like that, because they're building up all this fluid and they can't urinate. But however, no, the heart can do that as well in this case. And we had a yearling bull one time at Rouse, looked just like that. Looked like he had water belly, but when we necropsied him, he had died of heart malformations, right heart failure due to pulmonary hypertension. Okay, so let's talk about the heritability of pap. In general, probably the big question is coming out right now, how many animals are we losing to this? And on the feedlot side, I don't know. We'll get to that later. You know, in our cattle at Rouse Ranch on our experiment stations, even though we're bringing in outside AI sires in our breeding program and so forth, The number of animals we actually lose is pretty small. It's because our team is pretty good at knowing what it is and trying to do something about it. But in general, we'd say if you're talking about native cattle that have been in the mountains a lot and raised in the mountains, the percentage losses are pretty small. 2, 3, 4% or less. Like at Rouse Ranch, we would lose probably less than 1% of our animals. The question is, in the feedlot cattle, how much is that? I don't know. If you bring cattle from low altitude to high altitude, though, you can really have a train wreck there. We're working with a ranch that's on the backside of Rocky Mountain National Park right now, and they brought cattle just from Nebraska to there, and yeah, they had a train wreck with that deal. And so, there's some real issues there. Some of those can go 20 to 40% losses, depending on the age of the cattle and so forth. And I could tell anecdotal stories about that all the time. My favorite one, though, is about John Wayne and the Cowboys. Anybody knows the movie John Wayne and the Cowboys? They brought those colored cattle, because they wanted cattle with lots of color for the movie. They brought those from the Gulf Coast up to Durango, Colorado for that. And so every morning they had to go out and pull the deads out of the herd so they could film that day before they saddled John Wayne's horse, because that really wasn't a good thing to do. Okay? So, yeah. Lots of death loss, but overall the heritability is, and lots of studies. Some guy named Mark Inns, he worked on this as a graduate student, 1992, my God. You know, he said the heritability was a 0.46, but most of them come out in the moderate range. Connie Shirley was a postdoc in our program. Natalie Crawford, she works at Zoetis now, she did a study. Rachel Pauling did a big project with American Angus, and I think Kelly's going to talk about more of that data when she talks in a minute. Miranda Culbertson did a big analysis with some of Lee Leachman's composite data, 7-breed composite. And most people would conclude that thing is about, you know, a moderate heritability, and that's why we spend so much time talking about it in the West. The genetic correlation between weaning PAP and yearling PAP, we had a student work on that, said that was a 0.67. Yeah, so a high PAP at weaning is going to be a high PAP at yearling, but what would be the genetic correlation between either of these and feedlot PAP? We don't know. We never had a data set where we could do that yet. We're trying to get that done, but we don't know that. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit just quickly about PAP at our experiment station in Wyoming. This would be the Rouse Ranch. This right here would be an elevation 7,200, 7,400 feet, and Angus heifers that we would be out there grazing in the wintertime. Okay, so let's just look at this one line of data in this really busy slide. So this right here in this table would be the heritability of PAP, and then across all of this would be the genetic correlation of PAP with other traits, particularly growth gait. Because as I started down that road of talking about all this anecdotal stuff that people have said to me since I moved to Colorado, an interesting one is everybody looking for this one magic gene that causes this. We ain't found that yet. And that actually started by scientists at CSU more than 100 years ago saying that they thought there was some magic gene that was causing this, and they were going to hope they could find it. And that hasn't happened yet, and I'll talk more about that in a minute as well. But another thing that people have said, well, it's all that selection for growth. That's what's causing all this. And so our data sets, not only this data set, but also the one that Rachel Pauling worked on, would say that the relationship between PAP and growth, it might be slightly positive, but it's not much. Okay, which is really good news for people in the Western U.S. because it says we can continue to select for growth, and we can select for PAP. You know, and they're almost independent traits. One's not driving us into the trouble of the other one. Okay, and so this is just genetic trend. We've talked a lot about rate of genetic change today. I think I saw 3 talks this morning put that equation up there. Do we need a student to write it on the board again? Okay. Yeah, so I just wanted to show this. We genotype all of our cattle today. Our data set now is above 3,000 animals with various high-density genotypes, and that would represent the green line. I'm not touching it, I swear. Anyway, so I'm just trying to show you that as we've selected lower PAP is better. So think maybe the timer's set on it or something. Yeah, we're making genetic improvement. And that's interesting in our herd. Our experimentation herd is not selected to be just low PAP. Yeah, our replacement heifers are low PAP. And our natural service sires were selected to be low PAP. But we have a unique relationship with three semen companies, ABS, Select Sires, and Gen X, and they provide us so many bulls per year. And we're trying to make at least 10 progeny per sire. So that helps our research, contribute that back to the industry, and then also, you know, we try to keep the genetic trend in our experimentation population kind of paralleling the Angus population, so therefore what other research we do, whether it's on fertility or cow-calf management or whatever, it's a very uniform or industry representative herd. Oh, now it doesn't want to switch. Okay, there it came. So I just wanted to show this, get back to that story of people looking for the magic gene. So yeah, a little more than 3,000 animals in this data set. This is a classic Manhattan plot. Some people have already showed these today. So on this axis here, that's chromosome 1 going over to chromosome 29, 30 chromosomes in the bovine, the X and the Y. And then on this axis is some level of statistic. This was done with a Bayesian analysis. What I wanted to show, the reason I circled that up there in this particular data set, I just wanted to show that a 0.3 on this is not very high. Okay, I think Jenny or somebody was showing Manhattans earlier today had like 0.007s. That was a different little model, and that's highly significant. But the reason I wanted to show this in a Bayesian analysis, if that number was like 0.9, then that would say, wow, we got a big effect. But what I wanted to show here is that when it comes to PAP, there is no magic gene. It's a highly polygenic trait with lots of small effects. And so that's what this means when we say Manhattan plot, right? That there's lots of little dots coming up off the graph, but not any one of them is huge. So there's lots of small effects, okay? Therefore, that's why, and Kelly's probably going to get up here and talk about that later, that this kind of trait works well with our current genome-assisted EPD program. It's the kind of trait that really works well with that. Okay, so I want to get back to talking about this spot right up here and start talking about, get out of the mountain cattle and start talking about feedlot cattle. So when I got to CSU about 5 years ago, I met Greta, and we had some other graduate students there, Joe Neary, who was also a DVM PhD student, and we started getting all these calls saying, hey, I got these cattle out in my feedlot, and they died of your mountain brisket disease. And I'd say, well, it's not my mountain brisket disease. You know, I didn't create it, that kind of thing. But, you know, and we would start investigating, you know, and like, we do see that. Our cattle that are high PAP at altitude, if we make them a steer and move them to the feedlot down at Akron, some of those also become high PAPers again as they get fat. But, you know, we would investigate that, and somebody would say, well, this steer died of high altitude disease, and we'd find out who the owner was, and they'd say, well, that's impossible. That animal came from right here in Brookings, South Dakota. So how did that happen? And we're like, I don't know. So we started researching it. And that's where Greta really got involved. But one of the interesting things, Joe Neary published this paper in actually the late part of 2016, which is some epidemiological data from a feedlot data system that has feedlots in both the U.S. and Canada. Fairly large data set, about 1 million animals. And we were just looking at, you know, causes of late feedlot death. And on this axis over here, we got time to death. So, you know, on feed 100, you know, like up here would be an animal that's been on feed 300 days. But what were some of those causes? You know, and we're talking about right here, CHF, congestive heart failure, bloat, enteritis, peritonitis, just various things. And it was kind of just eye-shocking that in this recording system that congestive heart failure was coming up as a pretty big source of feedlot death, particularly if the animals have been on feed for a while. Okay? And so actually, as we looked at that data, there was a lot of data collected in the early parts of the 2000s and then data later, you know, about a decade later, and we looked at, okay, what's the incidence of that? And the incidence had doubled in 10 years. But let's talk about what that really means. So maybe in the year 2000, maybe you get 5 deaths from this out of 10,000 head of cattle. And then 10 years later, maybe you're getting 10 deaths from this out of 10,000 head of cattle. That's not a lot. And so now we talk about it everywhere. This is my third or fourth major talk I've given this year on this subject, and lots of folks interested in it. So the challenge in that is we don't have any kind of cross the feedlot industry epidemiological data collection system. Are we getting more deaths because it's actually getting more deaths? Or are we getting more deaths now because we know what the deaths were from? You know, that's just a really good question. But we are getting lots and lots of people talking about this all the time. Okay, so as we started thinking about the feedlot heart disease and death things, we've just completed our second or third large study, but this was the first one we did, and where we sorted Angus calves into high and low PAP groups. Okay? And then we took them as calf feds, fed them, you know, through the winter. These were fed at altitude, and then we slaughtered those calves and got heart data and so forth. But what I wanted to show you was, in today's world, we spend a lot of time talking about designing studies to go find some high-PAP cattle and low-PAP cattle to do studies. And initially, when we started talking about that, we'd be talking about how many hundreds or even 1,000 animals we'd have to PAP to get that done. But now what I'm telling you is that we can find those animals really quickly. So here's some calves that were fed and fattened at the Rouse Ranch. Okay? And their PAPs in this red, these ones in red right here, no matter what age and weight they were about 40 or less. Here's some calves that started out pretty low but then went to extreme high levels, way up above 100. And these ones that are dotted lines, those were the ones that became compromised. So it was like we had in the high PAP group, we got two groups, high PAP that are healthy and high PAP that are sick enough that they're compromised. Okay? And so we created those and we collected a lot of tissues. And we did what we call RNA sequencing to try to determine what were the genes that were actually being turned on or off because of those conditions. Okay, so comparing the high ones to the low ones. And I'm not going to go through everything in this slide because it's a lot of data. Okay, but what I wanted to tell you is that each one of these is a different physiological category, and there's more than 100, some cases 200 genes that were different between high PAP and low PAP animals. So it's huge amounts of differences. And what were those genes if we put them in categories? Well, it starts out, usually there's a bunch of genes that have to do with inflammation. Okay, and that's not inflammation because the animal contracted disease. We took great care in making sure that the animals that we did this were didn't have BRD or hadn't had previously had BRD or anything like that that would have caused inflammation. Okay, this has to do with pulmonary hypertension. Okay, so a lot of genes that changed that did do with inflammation, a lot of genes that changed that had to do with metabolism. So we're changing from aerobic metabolism, oxygen, to anaerobic metabolism. The cells are sensitive to that. And then lots of genes changing that have to do with tissue remodeling. That would make sense, right? Because the arteries and veins are becoming inflamed. We can't push blood through the lung, and so the pulmonary artery responds to that. The right side of the heart responds to that. So there's lots of tissue remodeling to this condition. Okay, so another thing that we did at Rouse Ranch, what we will do is we're a kind of a classic seed stock program. We'll raise our calves. In the fall, we'll wean. We'll have about 200 bulls, 200 heifers. And out of those bulls, then we'll select the better end of that to go into our bull test, and then the rest of those become steers, and they leave the Rouse Ranch and go down to the Eastern Colorado Research Center, and we usually fatten them and finish them there after a little bit of stop through the feed intake unit so we can get that kind of data. And so here's that kind of classic bell curve of PAP over here, but we started just asking the question of, so what the heck is the impact of high PAP on feedlot performance? Because we're sending cattle out of Rouse Ranch. The ones that got high PAP at the ranch, they get made steers, and then they go down to the feedlot. What's the impact of that? So we started asking that question. And so we just asked a simple question. There's about 900 steers in this data set. We asked the question, what is the impact of PAP, high PAP, and that would be on this axis, on overall carcass weight? Okay. And you notice if you take our steer data set and you draw a bell curve on it, it's almost a mirror image of high PAP as the other trait. Okay? And so if you fit a line through all the animals of PAP and carcass weight, you get no effect. But if you fit a line for those animals that were only in the high risk category, we're starting to see that as Hyatt Pap went up, those animals are doing poorer in the feedlot, which I'm saying poorer because we got less carcass weight. Those kinds of things. So we spent a lot of time talking about that, and we said, well, that's really interesting, but what do we really know about these feedlot cattle? And so that led us to start to do some other work and to write a grant. So some of the other work, thank you for telling me that, Jenny. Some of the other work is Greta was doing her residency in pathology at the CSU Vet School, she would get these calls and say, hey, I've got a steer out here in my feedlot on the Eastern Plains that had died of brisket disease. And so Greta started gathering up those tissues and samples from those animals and starting to evaluate that. And so we did that at the same time we wrote a USDA grant to study this. And so I'm going to talk about those two data. So I'm going to show you some slides that are out of Greta's of a paper that we recently published. And so these are steers out on the Eastern Plains. And a lot of these steers, we don't know their background. So we don't know whether they came from a mountain ranch or from Iowa or wherever they came from. But these are cattle that are on the plains, so we would say at moderate altitude. And these are just various, the forms of pulmonary hypertension, things we would know other than papping them to know that. So here's an animal that clearly has sternal edema or brisket disease. Here's one that the pressure is so high that it's obvious to see the jugular vein, right? It'd be pretty easy to teach a graduate student how to stick a needle in that, right? Right? And here's one that's got intermandibular edema, so under the chin. She doesn't have one that's got kind of the water belly look, but if we probably take a look around, we can find one of those too. But those are just some examples of seeing animals in the feedlot that got pulmonary hypertension or suffering from pulmonary hypertension. I put this up here because with Dr. Crafts in the room, I'm not going to embarrass myself and try to talk about histopathology. But the reason I wanted to show this is because this is stuff that Greta's showing us about things going on in the lung. And so why do we talk about the heart so much? Because you open an animal up in the feedlot for a necropsy, even I can do that, look at it and see the heart's malformed. That's easy to talk about. But when you start talking about the lung, it does require histopathology to know if whatever the issue was causing things in the lung, okay? And even the recent cattle we've killed on projects, I'm not seeing like hugely black smokers-looking lungs, those kind of things. They're all pretty pink. And so it takes some pretty good skills to know that malformation is occurring in the lung. But a lot of what you'll hear about is kind of these pictures right here is where you'll start to see all this excessive buildup fibrosis around the vessels in the lung. And so what that's telling you is that inflammation has occurred and that lung has lost its elasticity. And so if that's happening in the lung, then that starts to back up to the pulmonary artery, which starts to back up to the heart. And I just wanted everybody to see that. And so there's some graphs that shows that. So these were some control animals versus animals that came in that had died of congestive heart failure, and difference between venoconstriction and adventitial hyperplasia. That's what this is meaning right here, is that there's just a fibrosis starting to grow around the lung, around the vessels in the lung. And so yeah, that's causing pulmonary hypertension. So that kind of data helped us get the current USDA grant that we're working on. And so we're in the early phases of this grant, but we've gotten through the animal product part of it, growing cattle with potential for pulmonary hypertension and harvesting those cattle. And we harvested and finished that on Monday. So we're glad to have that done. So what we did to make this project happen was, Eastern Colorado Research Center has clients that have worked with them for many years, and we went to our feedlot manager and we said, hey, do you have any particular herd that really has a problem with this? And he said, oh yeah. And so he put us in touch with the guy, and Dr. Enns was kind enough to let us use the Rouse account, and we went out and bought some steers with a history of pulmonary hypertension. He'll probably never do this again. He will never let me do this again after I start telling you how many died. Okay, and so we did that. And, you know, we brought these calves in. As calf feds, are weighing, 600 and something pounds, and they go on feed and in about September, October. And, so they're just Angus cross steers. This is a picture of them on kind of a rainy day, fall rainy day. The elevation of Eastern Colorado Research Center is 4,100 feet. Akron, Colorado. It's about halfway between I-25 and the state line going east. that kind of thing. And the cattle, the cooperator, the cattle that we use for later part of the study, no history of BRD. And so we really worked well with this cooperator to have their health records of the feedlot and so forth. And so I'm going to tell you about this study. And so our goal here was to, again, identify low and high PAP cattle. Okay? And at first, we were starting to worry about that. You know, how hard would that be? And this particular ranch feeds about 500 head a year, and we're like, God almighty, we're going to have to PAP all 500 of them. We could have probably got our two groups out of about 50 head. Okay? And we're talking right now, these cattle have just come up on feed. They only weigh, at this point, 700 pounds. Okay? And we can already start to sort them in what we would call low PAPers and high PAPers. And so here's our bell curve again. A lot of animals over here in the low risk side, around 40. And then already starting to see this tail go out here. And so at 700 pounds, we already had a few cattle in there that had PAP way up there, about 90. Yeah, if a person went into the ICU and was determined to have a PAP up 90, there would be some, you know, serious scuttling around the hospital about what they were going to try to do about that. Okay? But we had that in a 7-weight calf, you know, in just a normal set of feedlot calves. Okay, so then we PAP them again. We PAP them the first time in December. There it is. PAP them the first time in December, and then we PAP them a second time in March, and now they weigh about 1,100. Okay? And what you should start to see here is, look at the variation start to expand in these groups. There's 107 of them total. And our mean may not be changing much, but our distribution on our bell curve is starting to really widen out because we're getting more of these high PAPers. So here's a picture of one that, this is what they looked like at about 1,100, when they weighed at this March time, they weighed about 1,100. This is the steers here. These are Harmon steers in this pen here, and then here's one, you can see that right there. He's already developing brisket disease. And that's Dr. Tim Holt back there. And, yeah, he's a veterinarian spending most of his time trying to save animals that probably aren't going to be saved. Okay, so that's what that would look like. We PAP these animals a third time this spring before we started slaughtering them. And, again, you know, the mean of this deal isn't changing much, but what's starting to really change is this bell curve, particularly on this PAP all the way out here in May. You know, is really getting wide. And so to have some high PAP, low PAP groups to do a viral challenge, that kind of thing. I'm not going to talk much about that data today. It wasn't hard to find a group to do this study. Okay? The X's, this is something that we just got done. So we just slaughtered these cattle this past week. So right over here. They weighed, you know, 1,350, 1,400 when we slaughtered them. I'm going to expect, you know, 80% choice in the group. Some pretty nice big-looking steers. But what I got here on is the X's, and this is why Mark Enns is upset with me. These are the ones that have died. Okay? And look at where they died. So we started the study over here, and we're moving across time like this. We lost one calf kind of early out of that 107. It did end up being kind of a classic shipping fever, BRD, sick calf kind of thing. But the rest of these, there's the one I just showed you a picture of. And that calf did have developed BRD, but we're not sure which came first. Pulmonary hypertension, BRD, he got it late. The rest of these all died of classic pulmonary hypertension. There's no record whatsoever that any of those cattle had ever been treated for a respiratory disease. But look how late in the feeding period they died. Yeah, so my research project owes Dr. Enns his cattle fund for six dead animals. Yeah. So I've got to come up with that money somehow. Yeah, here's a picture. I just wanted to show you this. They're not great pictures. They're just cell phone pictures. These are the cattle on feed. Again, we keep hearing this kind of anecdotal thing. It's all that selection for growth that you guys have caused this. Okay? So which one of those animals do you think died of pulmonary hypertension? Everybody thinks it's this one, right? Yeah, this guy, no, that's a big, he's a big burly bruiser now. No, he went through it just fine and dandy. It's a big old carcass, probably 1,000-pound carcass. This little one right here is the one that died. he developed it. You can't really see it here, but he was already starting at that point to start to develop the brisket, and you could hear him wheezing when he, I mean, he's in bad shape. But maybe that's why he was kind of a little hard doer, is that he was starting to suffer from this probably at a pretty early phase, and he just never did very well in the feedlot. But yeah, this is the one that died. And so, yeah, that's just one of those Mythbuster things about this. Every time we have done these PAP on this set of feedlot cattle, I asked the technicians working for him, I said, what was the correlation between PAP and weight? Almost nothing. Almost nothing in this set of feedlot cattle. Okay, so what are some conclusions, things we've learned from doing this? Yeah, PAP is an indicator trait of hypoxia, pulmonary-induced hypertension. Cattle have fairly high PAP relative to other species. It's just the way they are. Okay, so anything that stresses the pulmonary cardiopulmonary system, probably not going to be too good. Okay, and I say that with Bos taurus, about Bos taurus cattle, because I do not know anything about this in Bos indicus cattle. I do know of one Brangus bull that when I still worked at New Mexico State that went to high altitude in New Mexico and passed. But I don't have any knowledge of Nalori cattle or Brahmin cattle. Would they ever have this or not? I just don't know. PAP in general, we call that a moderate. We've done enough heritability estimates today. We'd call that a moderately heritable trait, and it's highly polygenic. Okay, there's not some magic gene that's going to come out of this that's going to solve the problem. Now, knowing the genes might help us do it better, but there's not a magic gene in this deal. When we talk about high mountain disease, you know, the biggest indicator, at least when we look at a necropsy in a gross sense, is the right side of the heart. That tells us a lot. And if you look at the liver, condition of the liver, that will tell you a lot too. And so, yeah, high mountain disease is classic. Right heart failure is why those animals eventually die. When we look at feedlot disease, it's the right heart, but also Greta's data, and I didn't talk much about that today. You have to get Greta to come back and give a talk next year, and she can talk to you about uniqueness of things happening on the left side of the heart, which is also very parallel to a lot of cardiac issues in extremely obese people today. Kelly Ritalik's going to get up here next and talk about the EPD and altitude cattle, but when she talks about that, she's going to talk a lot about the trait being something above 6,000 feet, okay? And then generally, I mean, you know, what's my big conclusion about all of this pulmonary hypertension, particularly as it relates to feedlot cattle? We just got a lot to learn about that. When I started that position at CSU 6-7 years ago, you know, it was just kind of a whisper here and there of somebody that would talk about it. But today, it just seems like everywhere I go, somebody will say something about it. You know, it's becoming more known. And again, I don't know, is that because it's more prevalent or we're becoming much more educated in what we're talking about? Those kind of things. So, it finally worked, Mark. No, it didn't. Anyway, I'd be happy to answer questions. That's a couple pictures from Greta's recent paper. These are feedlot cattle. Animal on the right, obviously got brisket disease versus animal on the left, it's normal. Yeah, well, several questions.
You,